I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome once again to another episode of History Dweebs. I'm Tim, and I'm joined today by the very honorable, distinguished, mild-mannered Colonel Charles Beauregard Hawk Waters III, affectionately known as the Southern Gentleman. How are you today, Charles?
Timmy, I couldn't be more relaxed today.
Well, I know, because today's just me and you.
It's just me and you.
Normally we have Brandy and we have Brittany. But, of course, Brittany's getting acclimated to her new job. And, you know, I don't know what Brandy's doing. We can speculate because she never listens to the podcast.
I believe Brandy down on a riverboat at the gambling casino.
And probably. She's probably gambling and drinking and who knows what.
She was sending me texts last night about 4 o'clock in the morning all drunk.
I think she was trying to get some narcotics or something. No, we're just kidding. Brandy is home with a sick child. So, Noah, get better soon.
Yeah, little guy. Poor little guy is having problems with his some ear infection maybe.
Yeah, I think he had double ear infection. So we probably just violated it by announcing that, but. Anyway, and you're getting ready to go on vacation, I know, Colonel.
I'm getting ready to go up to the beautiful state of Michigan.
It's the Big Blue. Places.
What's that?
The Big Blue.
The Big Blue. It's one of the prettiest places you're ever going to go to. And I'm staying in a cabin that's 200 yards from the dog beach.
So nice.
So can run up and down the beach.
So Rudy will have a blast. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm glad you're not taking him to downtown Detroit or someplace.
You know, Rudy, I believe Rudy will fare well in downtown Detroit.
Actually, Detroit's kind of nice because you got the Motown sites and stuff. So it's kind of cool. So we'll have a good time. And now you can, after we do this podcast, I know you're getting out of here, then you can listen to the podcast on your way to Michigan.
I'll listen to it on the way. And you know, the thing that's nice about it, what's peaceful is it's like the perfect day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting ready to go to vacation. It's a beautiful day out.
It is. It's lovely here in southern Ohio.
And the devil ain't here.
Yeah.
The devil ain't here with us.
Yeah. It's Friday. I mean,
it's Friday. And I was thinking about this. You know, and Brittany, the young lady brings a lot to the program.
Yes. And Brittany sure does.
She sure does. The devil kind of dead weight. And this is a complicated subject and a complicated issue.
You're saying it's over her head? Is that what you're saying?
It might be a little over her head.
She is going to kill you. But she doesn't listen to the podcast.
That's pitiful. Why do we even keep her?
I don't know. You know, it's our charity. It's kind of a...
Well, it's true.
Yeah. But you can listen to it on your trip up to the Great White North. Are you... how long is that? What kind of drive is that?
We're not going to the Upper Peninsula, so it's only about a 6.5-hour drive.
No, that's not bad. Well, you can listen to the podcast. I listened to some of our old podcasts when I flew to Columbia a couple weeks ago.
Listened to them when we was first beginning, and I've noticed how smooth and slick we've gotten since then.
Yeah, we're kind of too polished now.
Yeah.
We have that problem.
We've lost our hominess.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Our folksiness.
Okay. All right. So let's jump right into this topic because
we got to do our obligatory shout out to Dottie Scott.
Okay. And to Scott K. He's been working hard on a couple podcasts we'll have coming up. So shout out to Mom. Shout out to Scott and all our friends on Facebook. If you haven't checked, if you're listening to us on iTunes, leave us a review. But if you haven't checked out our Facebook page, check us out. Just search for historydweebs.com. Like us, follow us. We've got a lot of kind of cool stuff on there. I think you'll like it. But anyway, let's get into the topic. And today's topic is Charles Whitman. And Charles Whitman was an American engineering student at the University of Texas in Austin. He was a former U.S. Marine, and also, just a tad bit more information on him, Colonel, he was a mass murderer. He killed 16 people back in 1966.
Yeah. He was really the first American. It came at kind of a time when we really, I mean, we'd had mass murders before. We had, you know, Starkweather.
Right.
He didn't kill nearly, but.
But on that scale.
And this is when we had, you could dispatch news crews out.
Right.
To get, you know, I mean, because this went on for a little bit. It wasn't, you know, like a movie theater thing that we have, you know, it seems like every day now.
Yeah. Yeah. These shootings are common now, but back in the day, this was, you know, this was, like you said, this was kind of the first, with television and everything, the first like mass, shooting. I remember when it happened. I was very young. I was like 5 years old, but I do remember when it happened. And I remember people saying how odd it was. Now, of course, like you said, every other day you know, someone's shooting up a movie theater or a school or something, but this was quite weird at the time. And I think this is a story is interesting to me because he had at least some level of insight into what he was doing. He knew something was wrong.
He knew something was wrong with him. And he was when he was younger, a young boy, he was, he tested out at 138. His IQ was 138.
Yeah, he was very smart, very smart. So let's talk a little bit about his background. So Charles Joseph Whitman was born in Texas on June 24th, 1941, he was born in Lake Worth, Florida. He was the oldest of three sons born to his mother, Margaret, and his father, Charles Whitman Jr. Whitman's father had been raised in an orphanage in Savannah, Georgia. And you ever been to Savannah, Colonel?
I have been.
It's a beautiful city.
It's beautiful but hot.
Yeah, it's hot, but it's a very beautiful area, the coastal Georgia there. Anyway, his father was raised in an orphanage, and he described himself as a self-made man. In 1940, he married Margaret, who was then 17 years old. The marriage was pretty rocky. It was marred by domestic violence. Whitman's father was admitted authoritarian, and he demanded perfection from his family, from his kids. He was known to be physically and emotionally abusive, and this was all the way his whole life. Charles Whitman, growing up, he was exposed to this. As a boy, Charles Whitman was described as polite, well-mannered. He seldom lost his temper. He was very intelligent, as the colonel mentioned. He was examined at the age of six, and had an IQ of 138. Whitman's academic achievements were encouraged by his parents, but he kind of had, even though he was very smart, he was kind of lethargic in his studies at times, and when he didn't live up to his father. Expectations, you know, he would be often be beat. His mother was a devout Catholic. She raised her sons in the same faith. They regularly attended mass. Whitman Sr. was a fire. He collected guns. He was a gun enthusiast and taught each of his boys an early age to shoot, to clean, and maintain their weapons, as I know you I'll do as well, Colonel. He regularly took him on hunting trips, and young Charles, became an avid hunter and very accomplished marksman. His dad said of him that he could shoot an eye out of a squirrel by the time he was 16. So he was showing signs of talent in that area at a very young age. At the age of 11, Whitman joined the Boy Scouts, and he earned a total of 21 merit badges in just 15 months. And he went on to be an Eagle Scout, wasn't he one like the youngest Eagle Scout?
He was 12 years old. He was the youngest at the time. He was the youngest, and I don't know if that record's been broken. Mm-hmm. He was the youngest Eagle Scout, youngest person to ever achieve Eagle Scout status.
Yeah, And that's in the world. I mean, in the world.
Yeah, because I know people who have become Eagle Scouts and they've all done it when they was 18.
Yeah, they're adults, basically. Yeah. On September 1st, Whitman also was an accomplished pianist at a very early age. So he had a lot of talent. He was very smart, had a lot of talent. Was able to accomplish a lot when he was young. On September 1st, 1955, he entered high school, where he was moderately popular, and his intelligence was noted by his teachers and peers. At age 16, he underwent a routine appendectomy, and was followed by a motorcycle accident. So he missed some school. He also had surgery to remove a blood clot, which had formed in around his left testicle.
And you don't want a testicle blood clot.
He had
the blue balls, Tim.
He must have. And that's not a good thing to Yeah, you don't want that. Anyway, he missed a total of 16 days of school.
That'll make you climb a towel.
Yeah, but this was quite a little bit before that happened. This was like 8 years before that. So I don't know if it carried over that long, but you could almost excuse it if it happened right then. But anyway, 1 month in June of 1959, he graduated from high school. He was seventh in the class of 72 students, so he was in the top of his class. And he at that point enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. He didn't tell his father he had enlisted in the Marine Corps. Because about a month before his graduation, his father had beaten him and thrown him into the family swimming pool, almost drowning him, because Whitman had come home drunk after an evening socializing with friends. I'm sure you can relate to that, Colonel, in your youth.
In my youth, yeah. Colonel, a teetotaler.
Well, I know now you're a teetotaler, but, he was 17, 18 years old, so... it's not unusual for an 18-year-old to go out and have a few beers with his buddies, but his father didn't like it, beat him up, threw him in a swimming pool. So Whitman's response was to join the Marines without telling his father. So he left home on July 6th of 1959, and was assigned a 18-month tour of duty with the Marines at Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. His father still didn't even know he had enlisted after he left. During his initial 18-month tour of duty in 1959-1960, he earned a Marine Corps Gold Good Conduct Medal, a Sharpshooter's Badge, and so he was doing well. He received 215 out of 250 possible points on his shooting test, and did well when shooting rapidly over long distances and aiming at moving targets. So. After completing his assignment,
what's an important note there? That's where he learned how to shoot the M1.
Yes, which will come into play a few years later on. After completing his, which the M1, I guess at this time, this was before the M16, so the M1 was the standard
military issue rifle.
Yeah. So Whitman, after completing his initial assignment, he applied for a U.S. Marine Corps scholarship program, and his goal was to attend and complete college and become a commissioned officer. He entered the mechanical engineering engineering program at the University of Texas at Austin. Have you ever been to Austin?
I have been to Austin.
Is it nice?
And actually, my son, Taylor, just was in Austin this summer. He played the South by Southwest Festival.
Oh, yeah. They got great music down there.
I've been mistaken. Hold on. It's the Riverwalk. San Antonio.
San Antonio. But I hear Austin is a real cool part city. But anyway, he entered the engineering program there at the University of Texas at Austin on September 15th, 1961. He didn't do very well. He was a poor student, and... his grades were really not very impressive, but he started in college or maybe a little bit earlier in Marines, he started gambling, so he was showing little signs of compulsive behavior. Shortly after his enrollment at the university, him and two of his friends were observed poaching a deer A passerby noted his license plate and reported them to the police. They both were butchering the deer in a shower at Whitman's dormitory. Yeah. I don't know, man. I don't know how that happens. You kill a deer and you take it to the dormitory.
Bitch all the way back.
Over across campus.
I've always been against hunting. Uh-huh. But, you know, my stepdad's from Tennessee and he likes to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, two instances. One, he liked to squirrel hunt and rabbit hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And he always wanted me to go with him. And my big thing was, I don't like getting up early in the morning.
Yeah, you kind of have to get up early in the morning to get a deer.
Yeah, and then he gives me he said, I got you your own vest. I'm like, hey, it's an orange vest, orange construction vest. I was like, what the hell I need a vest for? I thought it was a bulletproof vest.
Right.
It was just a vest I threw over. I was like, what the hell I need this for? He's like, so people don't think you're a rabbit. I was like, hold on, you taking me out in the woods with a bunch of them bitches? They're going to mistake a 5'10" man for a rabbit? They all got guns? No, I ain't going out there.
No, that's stupid. Right.
So the colonel ain't never been hunting.
That's probably a good thing. But anyway, so they drag this deer on their campus into the dormitory and start cleaning it. Butchering it, and they're arrested, and he gets $100 fine. And just note this, because I thought it was kind of strange. And like you said, I don't know how you drag a deer across campus without...
That's too damn much work for some deer jerky.
Yeah, especially at the time, $100 fine was, you know...
That was pretty damn steep.
Yeah, 1960.
You could have got to a lot of steak for $100.
Yeah. Oh, I know. That was actually 1959. So that was a lot. But anyway, Whitman acquired a reputation of being a practical joker among his fellow engineering students. But they also noted he made some morbid and chilling statements. One such statement occurred in 1962 with one of his fellow students, Francis Shuck. They were at the bookstore in the main building at the University of Texas when Whitman casually remarked to him, pointing out the tower in the center of the campus, and Whitman remarked to his friend that a person could stand off an army atop of that tower before they got him. So some indication there that he's having these thoughts running in his mind. Anyway, in February 1962, Whitman meets Kathleen Frances Leisner. She was a teaching student who was 2 years younger than him, and that was his first serious girlfriend. They courted for 5 months, and in July of 1962, they announced their engagement. They were married then the following month of August 17th, 1962. In Lesner's hometown of Needleville, Texas. Ironically, the couple chose the 22nd wedding anniversary of Whitman's parents as the date for their wedding. And I say ironically because as we go to this story, Whitman started to keep a diary, and by reading the diary and what was in the diary, highlighting what's in the diary, you could tell that he just had this, he grew up in a very abusive situation, and his parents, or his father was very abusive, not only to him, but to his mother. They would separate later on. We'll get to that in a bit. But I thought it was ironic they chose that date as a date to get married, when his parents' marriage was far from ideal. Anyway, after he got married, his grades started to improve somewhat at the University of Texas, but not enough for the Marines because they said his performance was unacceptable in terms of the scholarship. So they yanked a scholarship from him, and the Marine Corps returned him to active duty in February 1963, where he was stationed at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina to serve the remainder of his five-year service. And I always, I mentioned this to you off air that I always assumed that I always thought there was some post-traumatic stress involved with this. Mm-hmm. But Whitman never did serve in combat. He just served stateside. Yeah. He was resentful that the Marines pulled his scholarship and he could not continue his study. But he was when they did that, they promoted him to the rank of Lance Corporal. But him and when he at Camp Lejeune, him and then a couple of his buddies were involved in an accident in which their Jeep rolled over an embankment. And Whitman saved his buddies. He singularly handled lifting the vehicle to free up, flipped it over by himself, and then he fell to the ground unconscious and was hospitalized for that. He had a reputation of being a good Marine, but he was known again to gamble during his time at Camp Lejeune, which eventually led to, in November 1963, for him being court-martialed for gambling and possession of a firearm on base. I don't you'd see like you would have a firearm. I mean, you know, Marine base, yeah. You think you would have firearms. But anyway.
No, he had an unauthorized
firearm. Yeah, unauthorized firearm. And he was threatening another Marine over a $30 loan, which he demanded $15 interest. So he was a little loan shark and going.
Yeah, $100 fine to pay.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, he was sentenced to 30 days confinement and 90 days of hard labor, and he was demoted from Lance Corporal back to private. In 1963, while he awaited his court-martial, he started his diary titled "The Daily Record of C.J. Whitman," and this diary gave a lot of insight to what he's thinking. And as I said before, he talked a lot about his abusive home life growing up, and later on talking about his irrational thoughts and kind of trying to figure out what was wrong with him. He knew the thoughts that he was having and compulsions were not normal, but he didn't know what was causing it. But anyway, in his writings, he wrote to his wife. He praised her and wrote how he longed to be with her. And he wrote his efforts and plans to free himself and his family from the financial dependence of his father. He had a lot of resentment for his father with his being abusive. In December of 1964, Whitman was honorarily discharged from the Marines, and he returned to the University of Texas at Austin, and this time entering and enrolling into their architectural engineering program. To support himself and his wife, he worked as a bill collector for the Standard Finance Company. Later, he worked as a bank teller at the Austin National Bank. In January of 1965, he took a temporary job with Central Freight Lines as a traffic surveyor for the Texas Highway Department. So he's doing everything he can to kind of, you know, put it in their young couple. They're just getting started. And wife's a teacher. She's graduated, becomes a biology teacher at Lanier High School there in Austin. And he volunteers as a scout leader because, as we said, he was an Eagle Scout when he was younger. So a couple of his friends has later testified, worked with him with the Department of Public Safety, testified that he had told him that he had struck Kathy on two occasions, his wife, which really bothered him because he wrote in his journal that he wanted to be a good husband and not abusive like his father, but it was almost like he couldn't control it. Mm-hmm. In May of 1966, his mother, Margaret, announced that she wanted to divorce Whitman's father because of physical abuse. So young Whitman drove all the way to Florida to help his mother move to Austin. He was afraid that the father, if his mother tried to leave, his father would resort to violence, and he summoned the local police to help him clean out his mother's house and where she packed her belongings and stuff. So he brought her back to Austin. She didn't live with them. They found her an apartment. She found work, but he was close. You know, he was close to his mom. So he's got his mom in Austin now. He's enrolled. He's back in school. He's starting out with his wife and their marriage. And so things seem to be looking up for young Whitman. His dad is trying to get mom back. He spends over $1,000 in long-distance phone calls. They still have long-distance charges.
Yeah, long distance.
I know. I mean, that seems like I didn't, you know.
And collect calls.
I remember collect calls.
They still have collect calls, but from the Justice Center.
you're right. But remember, you had to reverse. They always talk about reversing charges. Mm-hmm. And we had this thing where you'd call, just letting it, you know, your parents know you're okay. They wouldn't accept charges.
Two times.
Yeah. There's all kind of tricks.
Yeah. Yeah. You call up, say, you have a collect call from the Colonel.
Yeah.
And actually, my family didn't call me the Colonel, but.
Yeah. That would be really weird.
They wouldn't accept it because they knew. Okay,
especially if they said the colonel.
Yeah, if they said the colonel, they wouldn't know who was talking about.
Right. Yeah, but AT&T really.
It was a racket.
It was a racket. But anyway, so his dad spent a lot of money calling from Florida to try to get mom to return. And this kind of really stressed Whitman out. He didn't want his mom to go back with his dad. He started abusing amphetamines and beginning experiencing very severe headaches. And he would describe these headaches in his journal as being tremendous. So that leads it up to the fateful day of August 1st, 1966. On the eve of the shooting at the University Tower, Whitman wrote in his journal that reaffirming his love for his wife and his mother. And these final entries were written in past tense, so it suggested that he may have already killed Kathy and his mother, and that leads us up to the murders.
Well, and we're on August 1st now, and at 6:45 he sits down at a typewriter. Mm-hmm. He starts to type out a suicide note. And I'll just give you a big start of this. It says, "I do not quite understand what compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions I have recently performed." Now, this is after he killed his mother and his wife.
Yeah. So he leaves a couple of notes, right?
And when he killed his mother, he left a note right next to her. His mother's the first to go. Right after midnight, he goes to his mother's house, and he stabbed her in the heart.
Yeah.
And he leaves a letter next to her, and it says, "To whom it may concern, I have just taken my mother's life. I'm very upset over having done it. However, I feel that if there's a heaven, she is definitely there now. I'm truly sorry. Let there be no doubt in your mind that I love this woman with all my heart." Now, I'm going to tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
There ain't nobody walking around heaven who killed their mom. Okay?
Well, she might be in heaven. He just might not.
But he ain't up there.
He probably
ain't up there. You can do a lot of things in this world.
Yeah.
You can do a lot of things, but you kill your mama, you gotta do a lot of repenting before you can even get considered for a.
And was there some indication he may have drugged her or was it his wife? I know you may.
They're not sure how his mother died. He stabbed her in the heart, but there's some dispute as to whether how she died,
mm-hmm.
and whether he hit her over the head first, knocked her out, what he did with her. They never have been real clear on that. Now he comes back home to his house
after killing his mother, stabbing her in the heart.
Yeah, and then finds his wife Kathy, and she, for whatever reason, slept naked.
I don't blame a woman for that.
You know, they always mention when people sleep naked. I don't know.
Marilyn Monroe was found nude.
Yeah. So, but he's
nude in the shower.
Times.
Yeah.
And then he left a note for her, and it says, "I imagine it appears that I have brutally killed both of my loved ones."
Yeah, and it's after reading the story, you get the sense that these are the two most important people in his life.
I mean, they're the only people he had.
Right.
And says, "I imagine I brutally killed both of my loved ones. I was only trying to do a quick, thorough job. If my life insurance policy is valid, please pay off my debts.
He was responsible.
Yeah, he was responsible. And this is where it gets interesting. "Donate the rest anonymously to a mental health foundation. Maybe research can prevent these further tragedies." I mean, he's compelled, and he can't.
But he has some self-awareness. He knows that what he's doing is wrong.
Yeah.
He knows what he's doing is not normal. His thoughts are not normal. But he, like you say, he's compelled to take these actions.
And it's almost, if you could, he's almost a, I don't know if you could make a case, but he's almost what the definition of the insanity defense.
Mm-hmm. He can't control his actions.
Wrong and you can't control your actions.
Right.
And he knew it. And he said, so now at 6:45 in the morning, he starts to write a suicide note. And he says, "I do not quite, now I'm not going to read the whole note.
Right.
It's a
right.
long rambling. But here's some insight into it. And it says, "I do not quite understand what compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions that I've recently performed." That's killing his mother. "I do not really understand myself these days. I'm supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. And he writes that he wants an autopsy to be performed on his body to determine if there was a biological reason. So, I mean, this guy's just, he knows he's messed up. He's completely messed up.
And he says he kills his mom and his wife to save them the embarrassment.
Yeah.
So he knows at this point he's going to do something else. He knows that it's not, you know,
but
it's not going to stop.
But he doesn't, in his suicide letter, he doesn't mention the university or anything
like that. Right.
But there is, you know, because he starts hoarding. He knows he's going to do something because he's hoarding supplies. He went into the 7-Eleven and, you know, started buying, bought some Spam and a knife and some binoculars from a hardware store. And so now his mother's dead, and we're getting into where he's getting ready for the shootings.
Right. He's killed his mom. He's killed his wife. He stabbed them.
Yeah, and when he comes back, now he starts. Actually, he starts this note, and it says, "Friends interrupted, 3 a.m. Both dead." And then he continues on with the note, and he finishes it with pen, and it says, "I imagine it appears that I brutally killed my loved ones. You know, blah blah blah. Just, you know, as I wrote." So he started the thing, and then he didn't go through with it.
Right.
Or, you know, he got kind of,
you know, writer's block.
Yeah.
Yeah, writer's block.
Did. Yeah. And
so we have these two notes, his wife and his mother, or his wife, I mean his mother, and then we got this suicide note claiming responsibility, you know, and then, as I said, saying basically he didn't want to cause them embarrassment.
Now, at some point here, now, at some point through this, this is when he has decided that he is going to
go up on the tower.
Because if you see the list, I mean, and I'll just tell you the weapons he had. He had a 12-gauge shotgun. He had a Remington 700 with a 4x4 power scope, a 6mm Remington rifle, an M1 carbine. Now, this 700 rifle shoots a 308 bullet. It's like a 30-06. It's meant to take down fair. And this is one of those rifles that you can literally get shot in the arm and die because it blows the damn arm off and you bleed out. He had an M1 carbine. He had a 357 Magnum. He had a 9mm Magnum or a 9mm pistol. He had a 25mm pistol.
So he's armed to the teeth.
He had a machete, he had a hatchet, he had 700 rounds of ammunition, he had knives, he had a transistor radio, he had food.
Toilet paper.
Tape. Yeah. He had so much stuff that he had to rent a hand truck to get up to the thing.
And when he bought the guns, I think he mentioned to the clerk that he was going to kill wild dogs or something.
Yeah,
it was some strange.
Yeah, he did. He cashed a bad check to get all this stuff, which is kind of interesting.
What the hell?
$250. Yeah, he told the guy he was going to hunt wild hogs.
Wild hogs. Okay, yeah, I knew it. I knew it was something.
So he's buying all kinds of carbine magazines. So at about 11, and here's some, he takes dexedrine, water, Excedrin, everything. Dresses in khaki coveralls and a shirt and get jeans.
Yeah, I thought the Excedrin was, you know, kind of insightful because he had been claiming of these terrible headaches.
But dexedrine, I know, is a stimulant. I'm not really sure. His physician had given it. He'd been on Valium and dexedrine.
Yeah, they didn't, we'll get into it later, but they didn't do a toxicology test on him for some reason.
So now at about 11:35, he gets to the university. He's got all his stuff on a handcart. Well, he pulls in.
Yeah, like, you know, it's like the bringing the deer across campus. You think that would catch someone's attention.
So he gets a parking permit saying he's delivering equipment. He's using a fake ID to get in there. He wheels his rented dolly to the main building at a university. That's where the clock tower was.
And this tower is center of the
university. Center of the university.
Yeah.
So now he enters the main building. He can't get the elevator to work, and some lady named Vera Palma comes in and says, "Oh, here, let me do that for you," and turns it on for him. And he's like,
"Thanks a lot, lady."
And, you know, he says to her, "You don't know how happy this makes me." And
made him happy. It didn't make 14 other people very happy.
Yeah. So he gets up to he takes it up to the 27th floor. And that is the main, that's the observation deck. It's 28 floors, but the observation deck is one floor below the clock base. Right there. So he's got all this equipment up there.
He's got to haul another flight.
Yeah. So he gets up to the reception area. And a receptionist up there in Townsley is like, you know, "What are you doing up here?"
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, it's too late for her. He actually crushed her skull with his rifle butt.
Oh, man.
So she was his first victim. So a few minutes later, another couple were coming up there to see it.
First victim at the tower.
She was the first victim of the tower, yeah. But now another couple come up there, and they're going to take in the view from the observation deck. And the guy notices, a dark stain on the floor, and he thought it was a varnish.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't think much of it. So he passes. He thinks Whitman's up there. He sees him with the guns. He thinks he's up there to shoot pigeons, mm-hmm. to get rid of all the pigeons up there. They talk to each other, and exchange pleasantries, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitman lets him go on the way. I mean, doesn't shoot him.
Boy, that'll give you a story to tell later on at family get-togethers.
Yeah, now Whitman barricades a stairway so nobody can get up there. Now two families are coming up there because this, you know, University of Texas, this is an observation deck. So
right.
You can see.
You got an overview of the whole campus.
Yeah, so he...
school was in session.
Let's see. Yeah, the Gabor family is coming up here, and they're coming up the steps. And Mary Gabor said later that she and her sons had thought the barricade was in place for cleaning the reception area, and then Whitman in his khakis was a janitor. So 16-year-old son and his 18-year-old brother Mark, they try to look beyond the barricade and open the door. Whitman fired his shotgun, killed Mark, and shot Mike in the head, left shoulder. He killed one of them, but he didn't kill the other one.
You know, it's amazing. You wonder why he let that other couple go.
That's what's so weird, is that he talked to them and just let them go. Now, this other couple, maybe he was aggravated. They was aggravated.
Yes.
I think he was setting, I think he let them go possibly because he was not set up yet, mm-hmm. you know, to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So now the first shots are at, now these people are shot.
Mm-hmm.
Whitman's barricaded. Mm-hmm. He's set up.
And now he's looking out over the campus.
Yeah, it's 11:48. These time frames are important because this is what kind of makes this kind of a big thing. This lasted almost 2 hours.
Man.
You know, this thing went on for 2 hours. And this is when news crews could get there.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not going to go through the whole list of victims. We'd be here all day.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Some interesting things. The first shots were fired at 11:48. The first person he hit was an 8. Now, and I want you to think about something, too.
Mm-hmm.
He's on a 300-foot tower. Right. Okay, so if he shoots somebody 1 foot from the tower,
mm-hmm.
he's shooting them from 100 yards away.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right.
So he doesn't have a close shot on anybody.
Right.
He has a good vantage point, but he doesn't have every shot that he's firing is not close.
You know what? I mean, not to interrupt you, but when I was reading this, what I was thinking, it's almost like for gamers who play Grand Theft Auto,
yeah,
the Grand Theft Auto game.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of,
yeah.
Yeah, you're just picking off people walking on the street.
Random people.
Or, yeah, random people.
That's, he was almost, you know, it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Right.
I mean, not to be insensitive.
Right.
But, and the first person he shot was really, it was a horrible thing because the girl was an 18-year-old girl. She was 8 months pregnant.
Mm.
And he shot her in the abdomen. It did not kill her, but it killed the unborn child. So, you know, there's a list. And what starts happening here is as he's shooting people, people are coming to help. And this is kind of what Al-Qaeda and ISIS mm-hmm. and those have learned today, is that they set off bombs.
Right.
And they set off one small bomb to injure people. And when people start amassing to help, the second and third bombs go off.
Yeah. We were, I remember where, place I worked and, we'd get bomb scares and they wouldn't tell no one.
Yeah.
And you know, the employees found out later and complained, why aren't you telling anyone? And that's what they said,
mm-hmm.
because if it was a terrorist act, it's most likely that sometimes they'd give up fake reports mm-hmm. to get people out in
so
the street.
So they can get people out in the
yeah.
street,
right.
and that's where the attack goes.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really, I mean, really, people don't know what's going on, and he's such a good shot. You know, people, he can just hit people, you know, as he wants. And
yeah, he's shooting at will at this point.
Yeah, he's shooting at will. At one point, they send a plane after him. But there's too much turbulence.
Yeah, they tried to shoot him from the plane, don't they?
They sent a sharpshooter up
mm-hmm.
in a plane, and they got him. He, you know, so this is going on. He begins to fire people walking, not on the campus, but on Guadalupe Street.
Streets surrounding the campuses, yeah.
And here's one that he shot and wounded the basketball coach, Billy Snowden, from a distance of over 1,500 feet.
My goodness.
And right nearby her, he shot 21-year-old Sandra Wilson in the chest. Now, we're talking about 460 meters that this man is shooting people at.
It's amazing. And I guess when you see the, I mean, if, to me, what we're really, when you see the list of people that he killed, mm-hmm. It kind of brings it home. It's very lengthy. He killed a total of 16 people and injured, like 31?
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was, like Colonel said, he was picking people off just left and right.
Yeah, and you had, now, the first officer that arrived on the scene, his name was Speed, Billy Speed, 23 years old. He's the first one that gets there to the scene. And Whitman sees him, shoots him, and kills him. So he's killed too. There's one, and we can go through this. You know, the number again is 16 killed,
mm-hmm.
31 injured.
Mm-hmm.
And he's shooting things. You know, one victim. Let me go back to him, Tom Herman. He got shot in the wrist, and it blew his arm off. You know, so what I'm talking about, you know, mm-hmm. he's not shooting a 22. He's
right.
shooting high-powered rifles.
Right.
And that's why, you know, so many of these people had such devastating injuries.
Yeah, the death toll was so high.
One guy, Paul Sontag, for whatever reason, he got himself behind some construction barriers. He was 18 years old. He was 900 yards away from construction barriers. And there were three people with him, and this young man is popping his head up, and his friends are telling him, keep your damn head down.
Mm-hmm.
He popped his head off one time, and remember, 900 feet. I mean, he popped his head up one time, got shot straight through the mouth.
Mm.
I mean, Whitman had seen this guy. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Remember he had binoculars, right. He had a high-powered scope.
Right.
But, had he just sat there and – but this played out over a long, long time.
And people started responding. I mean,
people started coming up and they were actually – and they weren't really doing much good. The police later credited it mm-hmm. with at least
– distracting him.
And it kept him in a certain place. It mm-hmm. kept him undercover. He couldn't walk the observation deck freely.
Because people,
citizens were firing back at him.
Yeah, people, average people who was just happened to have a firearm started shooting at him in the tower, which limited his mobility.
Where he could be. He had to take a spot really between two columns and shoot out between that. So now all of a sudden his range is
limited.
Is very limited. So you have
I just think it must have been chaotic when he's shooting down on the campus, picking people off, and then people started just random people started returning fire.
Yeah, I mean it's like OK Corral.
That must have been crazy.
So the police are there. The police get there very quickly, but they don't know what to do. One Texas Ranger used a student as a spotter to help him locate him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Whitman decided he had to shoot through the water spouts. So that protected a lot of people from.
Yeah, because again, once again, it's limiting his range.
And then they sent up Marion Lee. He was a police sharpshooter into an airplane.
Yeah, that's the guy we were talking about, I think.
But the turbulence was too great.
So he starts shooting at the airplane.
Yeah, he started shooting in the airplane. Now, three policemen get there, and this one's interesting. Ramiro Martinez, Houston McCoy, and Jerry Day. Now, they start to advance up to the tower. Now, McCoy had seen his colleague, Billy Speed, get killed when he got there. So they start, they heard the radio reports, they run up there with a citizen. Alan Crum. So now, as everyone up there, they were the first to reach the tower's observation deck, and they get to the 26th floor, and they run into this Miss Gabor just had her son shot.
Right. So they're finding bodies.
Yeah, they're finding
the survivors.
Mike Gabor, who's still he's not dead. He says he's out there. So now Martinez and McCoy. Now remember, McCoy is a policeman, but Crum is a civilian.
Right.
So they get out onto this deck they want to encircle Whitman. So right before he gets to the southwest corner, Crum accidentally discharged the weapon he borrowed.
Oh man.
So now Whitman, who was unaware of either any of them being up there. He's now aware of it. So he starts to fire back, but his attention was drawn to where Crum had discharged his rifle.
Mm-hmm.
So even though this was, it turned out to be a good thing. Because as Whitman sits crouched, he's hiding behind, he's got covers. Martinez jumps out and fires all six rounds of his .38 revolver. Now he's shooting a .38 revolver, and to me, I shoot, and I'm not a bad shot.
Mm-hmm.
But a .38 police special of 50 feet is pretty iffy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Martinez fires, and he missed him. But McCoy jumped right in front to the right of Martinez, and he's got a shotgun, fires two shots, a double outbuck shot with his 12 gauge, and he hits Whitman in the head and neck.
Yeah, he saved the other Martinez bacon because
Martinez shoots his six rounds.
Right,
Martinez then gets a shotgun and he actually did hit Whitman in the arm, but Whitman didn't realize where they were and he's about to open up on him and Houston. Jumps out and shoots him twice.
Houston McCoy,
So McCoy jumps out and shoots him twice.
Yeah.
But Martinez gets all, he, at first, the media, Martinez is running around saying, I got him, I got him, I got him.
Even though he missed him.
And all you did, you missed him six times, and you nicked him on the elbow with a shotgun shot.
Yeah, and then your partner comes up.
Your partner came up and blew his damn head off.
And saved your ass.
And saved your ass. So
well, I tell you, both of them, all three of them, or four of them, you know, oh, man, that's courageous. I mean, I know that's her job, but I mean, that's pretty courageous going up in the tower where you got some psych up there firing away. And
well, and you know,
you earn your money now, that day.
And I talk about the timeline. They hit that tower. They got up to the top of that tower. Now, this shooting, remember, it started at 11:48.
Mm-hmm.
These policemen got to the top of that tower at 1:30.
Man,
so this has been going on for 2 hours. Two hours. Been shooting. And what, you know, what I did not understand going through all this is, how the hell was there only three policemen up there?
Yeah.
I mean, what, you know, what the hell was going on?
Yeah.
I mean, you have this, now you'd have the whole, and there's a couple, Billy Speed was a policeman who got killed, but there's one interesting kind of side note to this. In 2001,
mm-hmm.
David Gumby,
mm-hmm.
He was a student. He was an engineering student there.
Mm-hmm.
He got shot in the back. Well, during the shootings, he got shot in the back. Now, it did so much damage to his kidneys that his entire life he was on and off dialysis.
Mm-hmm.
It was very painful, very, you know, just obviously it made for a very bad life for a man. And in 2001, he decided to stop dialysis. Now, he was a very religious, conservative man. His friends all believed that he was actually committing a sin by stopping dialysis, but the pain and the misery and everything had become too much for him.
Mm-hmm.
And his kidneys were ruined by that shot. Well, he stopped dialysis in 2001 and died right soon after.
Mm-hmm.
His death was ruled a homicide from Charles Whitman.
So really, yeah, so... Is he? So then, is it?
He's the last victim.
The last one. So he is number. He's number 16.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's number 16. He's actually number 17.
Oh,
there were 16 killed there, but died later of injuries. Was David Gumby?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's kind of like that. It's kind of like James Brady was shot when Reagan was shot and died years later of his complications, and so really changed that. Charged to, you know, there were talks of changing the charge to John Hinckley to murder, because of the death of James Brady relating having been related directly to the shooting in 1981.
Yeah, and you had, I mean, and just to give you, you know, how this was going, you know, a history professor first called at 11:52. And this was another one, Roy Schmidt. He was 1,500 feet away when he got killed.
And these guys were,
And students, you know, the students and the staff, they were trying their best to get the wounded to safety, you know, and they're getting shot when they do it. And one student later said, that was a moment that separated the brave people from the cowards. I realized I was a coward. I mean,
I'd been digging a hole in the ground. I mean, that would have been some scary shit.
You know, the medical personnel that came in there, they were very brave, but they were using armored cars and provisioned ambulances from local funeral homes to reach the wounded.
And so, you know, they had time to get all that stuff together.
Yeah, and one of the victims was an ambulance driver, Morris Holman. He got shot in the leg. But again, you know, we're not talking about a 9mm. We're not talking about he got shot in the leg. Severed a major artery, he bled out.
Man, I'm telling you, it just seems like a game of Grand Theft Auto to me. I mean, it's, you know.
Yeah, you, and I mean.
People become, your victims are just almost, you know, you become insensitive to them as being really human beings. And
Just
shooting whatever moves, like almost like it's target practice or something.
And just what's so interesting about this guy is that, you know, there was an aftermath and. Then you're going to cover some of that. But, you know, what's so interesting about the guy is that he was an intelligent guy. He had no reason to, he was not, you know, so many of these guys you see in the movie shootings and the things like that, they're losers. They're outcasts in society.
Loners.
Discarded. Mm-hmm. He wasn't.
Right. He was intelligent, and he also had, like I said before, he had some insight. He knew something was wrong. He didn't know what it was.
He didn't know what was driving him to do this. And he had actually at one point, in talking to a psychiatrist back in March, said that he was just oozing with anger, and that he did mention he just wanted to climb a tower and shoot as many people as he could.
Yeah.
Now, that's, you know, not something a psychiatrist is... I mean, obviously, a psychiatrist is going to take that seriously, but, you know, he was
I think they would today.
They would, yeah, absolutely. Today, he said I was going to do it. I feel like going to the movies and shooting a bunch of people.
But again, this is a time when really the kind of mass murders, mass shootings really wasn't that common.
No, but I think what separated this, you know, and it wasn't that common. And I just saw, and, you know, statistics can tell you anything, but, mass shooting now is considered shooting more than three or more people is considered.
Oh, that's the definition.
Yeah. And I saw a headline the other day that said in 255 days, we're 255 days into the year.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, do you know how many mass shootings we had?
No, how many?
255.
Oh, my God.
One mass shooting a day, and that's a shooting of three or more people. And that is, now a lot of that is, you know, criminals.
Right.
We had,
but still, I mean.
You know, we had in our own, you know, our own city, we're starting to see a little bit more of it. And as, you know, because you have a lot, when you have gangs, when you have criminals, whatever, you're going to have mass shootings where.
And you got a lot of guns on the street.
Yeah, well, people were firing into crowds at one particular person.
Right.
You know, those count as mass shootings too. Sure.
Well, anyway, after this melee, and as the colonel said, 16 people were killed, the 17th died, I guess, recently. 31 people injured. There was a investigation. Whitman had been prescribed some drugs, dextrine, as the colonel said, but oddly enough, they didn't do a toxicology test on Whitman after he died. He was embalmed on August the 1st, the same day. So, I mean, it was kind of weird. But they did do an autopsy because it was requested, as the colonel mentioned, in the suicide note by Whitman, and then it was approved by his father. So the next day, an autopsy was conducted by a Dr. Chenault, a neuropathologist at Austin State Hospital, and blood and urine were removed from test traces of amphetamines or other substances. But during the autopsy, Dr. Chenault discovered in the brain a tumor the size of a pecan. Now, he concluded that the tumor had no effect on Whitman's actions that previous day. It's amazing how quickly they did that, you know.
Yeah. Like
right away. They embalmed him right away, and then they did an autopsy. You know,
and he wanted to be cremated.
Yeah, he did. He had a request to be cremated. But anyway, the results was that in that initial autopsy, that the pecan-sized tumor had no effect on Whitman's action. However, Texas governor at the time, John Connally, himself was a victim of course, the shooting when Lee Harvey Oswald shot from down on a crowd to assassinate President Kennedy. Connally, of course, was shot during that incident. Anyway, he was governor of Texas at the time, and he commissioned a task force of different professionals to examine the physical autopsy findings and trying to find material related to Whitman's actions and motives to try to figure it out. As you can imagine, this was a huge story. The commission was composed of neurosurgeons, psychiatrists, pathologists, psychologists, and the University of Health Center directors. The Connally Commission did toxicology tests on various organs of Whitman a few weeks after the body was exhumed. And it revealed, the toxicology test revealed nothing significant. But they did examine that tumor, and they concluded that the initial autopsy by Dr. Chenard that said that the tumor had not had any impact on Whitman's actions was actually in error, that the tumor they found conceivably could have very well influenced Whitman's action, because I guess it pressed on, and, you know, I'm not going to get on to the...
We had problems with that word when we were going to
Melanoma. Yeah, but anyway,
it's basically the region of your brain that makes you feel emotion, empathy.
Yeah, and the fight or flight response. So they believe the Connolly Commission came out with this report, and they believe that the tumor did in fact play a large part into Whitman's actions, and, you know, certainly that would explain the terrible headaches that he was having that certainly was bothering him. But anyway, that was their conclusion. Now, the commission also went as far to said that the state of Texas, University of Texas, and state agencies should provide aid to the survivors, including loans, to assist them with their medical and mental issues and support rehabilitations. Those recommendations were not put into effect. The investigative officers found that Whitman had visited, as you mentioned, university doctors in the prior year before the shooting, and that prescribed him various medications. He had seen a minimum of 5 doctors between the fall and winter of 1965. So this is just, you know, less than a year before the shootings. And then he met, as you said, he met with a Dr. Cochran, who was a campus psychiatrist, and he's where he made the statement that he was thinking about going up in that tower with a deer rifle and start shooting people. But it was never reported, so nothing was done about it. But anyway, a joint funeral for Charles Whitman, his mother and Margaret, his mother and his wife, Margaret was... his mother Margaret and his wife was held at the family's home parish on August 5th, 1966. So they were buried at the same time. And it's kind of odd, as a veteran, Whitman was entitled to burial with full military honors. His casket was draped with an American flag, and he was buried next to his mother at the Hillcrest Memorial Park. And as you said, he had requested to be cremated, mm-hmm. But he was buried. Interesting enough, his brother is John was had a violent death as well. He was murdered outside of a nightclub in Florida in 1973. He was later buried by his mother and brother. Following the shooting, getting back to the tower, the university closed the tower to visitors in 1966. In 1967, the university spent $5,000 to repair bullet holes left from the shooting, and the tower reopened in 1968. However, it became a target. It became like Golden Gate Bridge, yeah, sort of bridge. People started jumping from his tower to commit suicide.
And nobody had ever jumped from that tower before.
Not before, suicide. But now it became like this, suicide magnet. 4 people committed suicide between 1968 and 1974 by jumping off the tower. So the tower was closed again a second time in 1975. Now, 24 years later, in September 15th, 1999, the tower reopened. It's open today, but it's only by controlled access. So visitors are allowed in for a guided tour by appointment only, and after being screened by metal detectors. Other security measures include stainless steel doors were installed. Man, I just say shut the damn tower down, because some psycho is going to go up there again someday. It's just, close it down.
What I find interesting about him too is when you talk about all the mass shooters, mm-hmm. and you know, you got these guys now that are he is, even now, you know, from that time on, I mean, he had the funeral with his family. Mm-hmm. This was a guy who was never really demonized. We demonize the mass shooters, mm-hmm. justly. I mean, you don't walk into a theater. But this guy seems more of a sympathetic character.
I was going to say that. It's interesting you bring that up because I'm thinking while you're saying this, you know, if it's not for the play, other than that, how did you like to play Mrs. Lincoln?
Mrs. Lincoln, yeah.
But he seemed like a decent guy up to this day. He killed his mother and his wife and shot up 14 people. But you know, he obviously had concern for his mother. He wanted to protect her from the abuse of his father. He had a very challenging childhood. Not that that excuses his actions by any stretch of imagination. But like you said, he knew something was wrong. He just couldn't figure out what it was. And he, you know, he was basically pleading in these suicide notes, please do an autopsy and find out
what the hell wrong with me.
What's wrong with me? Because this is not rational. Anyway, so in January of 2003, the University of Texas at Austin committed $200,000 and sought another $800,000 to redesign the Memorial Garden on campus and dedicate it to recognize the deaths that occurred on August 1st, 1966. The Memorial Garden was dedicated in 2006, 40 years after the event. A bronze plaque dedicated to all those affected. And I believe it's like the wall in the Vietnam Memorial. The names all the names are on it. So that's why I said if you see it, Google it or something, it kind of brings it home. It hits home, I think, when you see names. You got names attached to these victims. But it lists all the names of the victims. So, yeah, this is a different one.
If you got on YouTube, you can see a little bit of the footage of because this went on for 2 hours. And again, this is when film crews, they couldn't do things live, but they could get there. Now, the problem, you know, they couldn't get too damn close because this guy was shooting people at 1,500 feet.
Sure.
So, you know, you don't have, you know.
You know, this is, 3 years after the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they had the ability to shoot footage there anyway. But like you said, you run the risk of getting...
Yeah, that's why you didn't have so much, you know, TV, because it lasted 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you had plenty of time for news crews to get there. But again, he's shooting ambulance drivers.
Yeah.
You know, he ain't going to have no problem shooting an anchor man.
Yeah.
So, you know, but he, and you know, what I found specifically when I realized, okay, this man's disturbed, because I don't know if you saw pictures of his mother, his wife, his...
I did,
very pretty wife.
Yeah.
Very pretty wife.
And he, of course you can't tell anything from pictures, it's stupid, but it's not like you're looking at a wild-eyed, crazy guy when you see
pictures. No, he was just an all-American boy.
Yeah, yeah. Blonde hair, young...
I want you to think about this. You're married, mm-hmm. you're young, you come home, your wife's sleeping naked, all right? You come home to a pretty naked woman.
Stab her in the heart.
Hey, you stab her in the heart.
Yeah, that was messed up.
Now, you know something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Something wrong with you because there's other things you could be doing.
Besides
stabbing him in the heart with a knife. Yeah.
He was a sick puppy, but.
The term deranged comes to mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, that something has scrambled your brain.
Yeah, he was twisted, and he knew he was twisted. So, mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? The commission's findings about the tumor,
that it had an impact on it.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, you look at, you know, they have yet to find a serial killer. They can almost take every serial killer that they found, mass mm-hmm. shooter, and they can find things that are pathological things that are wrong with their brain.
Organic problems
that are wrong with their mm-hmm. brain, and it's typical
abnormalities.
Frontal lobes, where people feel empathy, where mm-hmm. they connect emotionally with other people. When they did it with Jeffrey Dahmer, they mm-hmm. found it there. But all these people, they study their brains and they see that their brains are different than our brains.
You know,
it's not a thing that necessarily you're born with. You get now. He had a tumor, but a lot of these things are things that your brain has an elasticity to it
mm-hmm.
that events can change the way your brain's wired.
Yeah,
I mean, it can change what you do.
And you know, when we do a lot of these podcasts on these serial killers and mass shooters, The other, you know, you always go back and forth about whether it's organic or it's the environment, because all of them seem to have just horrific childhoods. I mean, Mary Bell's mom pimping her out at four or 5 years old and trying to give her away. And, so, I mean, almost all of them we've talked about, they've had some very brutal experience childhoods. But you're right. Perhaps that those experiences, there's an organic impact to that as well. So it seems that's the case with this guy. I mean, although he was abused, I think probably I agree with you that the tumor probably had the most impact on that made him go up in that tower. And he may have thoughts of it before, but to actually take that action, I think at tumor.
But the environment. It would have been one thing if he would have gone home and found his father and stabbed him to death.
Yeah,
but he was always concerned about his mother. His father abused him. He was always concerned about his mother. He was happy his mother got away.
Mm-hmm. Well, he drove down there.
All
the way from Texas to Florida to bring her back, to get her out of that environment.
And keep he her stabbed her. But again, you don't get a pass for that.
And
I'm telling you, listeners, you can do a lot of things. Now, Timmy, you just got back from vacation.
Yes.
You went down to see a young lovely young lady down there.
We had a very good time.
Very good time. And many of the things you did down there, you're probably going to go to hell for.
Probably, yeah.
But you didn't kill your mom.
No, I love my mom.
Yeah, well, of course you do. You got Dottie.
Yeah, she's a wonderful lady.
So all the things you did down in Columbia, you were probably drinking rum and whatever, partying.
Rum.
Doing a little limbo thing down on the beach with your skinny little Speedos on.
I did have a Speedo shirt on.
But you're probably going to hell for some of those
things. Oh, I'm sure.
And, but you can be forgiven because you didn't kill your mother.
No, I would never do that.
Yeah, and this guy.
Yeah.
Don't kill your mama. I mean, things can get bad. Things can get great. Don't kill your mama.
Yeah. We really don't kill anyone. We're not for killing anyone.
Well, unless they got a comment. I mean, sometimes people got a comment.
I did a post on, I forget the guy's name, but his tombstone was a gangster. It was a gunslinger. And his tombstone read, it's on History Dweebs, so I have to look up, but his tombstone read, he never killed anyone unless they had it coming.
Unless they had it coming. Yeah.
So, but anyway, these folks certainly didn't have it coming.
I'm trying to think of the movie Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood. Yeah. When he shot the guy and said, well, you had it coming, Clint Eastwood said, we all got it coming, kid.
Well, some truth to that, I guess. Yeah. Okay, well, Colonel, where can people find us?
You can, the best place to find us is get yourself on iTunes, type in History Dweebs. If you haven't listened to all of the episodes, listen to some of the episodes. Give us a rating. Give us an honest rating and some comments and some feedback.
We would love that. I think we have like 44, 45 episodes out there now.
So. Yeah, this drives what we, if you like the shows that we do, it kind of makes us choose what we're commenting on. Clearly, me and Timmy are, very intelligent men. Now, we got some dead weight that we carry with us, but, But we can overcome that. So if you want to hear about a subject, leave us a rating. Say, hey, I would like to hear more about the Virginia panty stealer or whatever. I don't know.
I'd like to hear more about that myself.
Yeah, well, you might be the Virginia panty stealer.
I've never been to Virginia lately. Okay, so, or check us out on Facebook and leave us a comment there. And
you can follow us on Facebook.
Absolutely.
Because if you like the page... my son and I'll tell you this, my sons they're busy boys and they don't, as I said, they don't always listen to the podcast, but both boys they follow the History Dweebs page, pretty closely on Facebook because it's just fascinating things that you come up with to put on there.
Yeah. It's fun. It's fun finding that stuff. Yeah. We try to keep it entertaining. And so if you haven't checked us out on Facebook, check us out. If you like a shout out, give us an email at timtscott@yahoo.com or leave us a message on Facebook. Or like the Colonel said, leave us a message on iTunes. We'll give you a shout out next podcast. Any final thoughts as you make your way to Michigan?
I'm going to make my way to Michigan. I am going to get on the edge of a dock.
And then I just picture the movie Vacation.
Our family is very much like the movie Vacation.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of things that go awry. There's a lot of...
You're the kind of Chevy Chase.
I am the Chevy Chase, and it's a quest. Everything becomes a quest for me. And there's the one moment in the movie where he, when things just go all to hell and the sun starts to pat him on the shoulder, and he says, don't touch, you know.
So you get a little tense.
I get a little tense, but I got three boys that will invariably, I got three of the funniest boys you're ever going to run into. So mm-hmm. they will, one of the things that I look forward to on vacation is I'm going to relax and I know I'm going to laugh because these boys are going to make fun of the Colonel. The Colonel going to kick their ass when they make fun of him, but
you'll be laughing on the inside.
I laugh when I kick their ass. Okay. But what the Colonel going to be doing next week is sitting on the edge of a dock. You're going to have a little bucket of worms.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be catching me some bluegill, sure. Some crappie, maybe an occasional bass.
And you're going to have your iPod there listening to History Dweeb podcast.
I'm going to be checking up on the History Dweeb's page and seeing if anybody leaves any comments. Hey, Colonel, could you do this for me? And I've been neglecting the Colonel's page, and we're going to have to do an Ask the Colonel episode.
Yeah, soon. Scott's been asking about that.
So if you have any questions, you have any life trouble, you have anything, put it on the history.
Marital problems,
erectile problems.
Dysfunction,
whatever. If you're having weight problems, whatever. Just financial problems.
Yeah. I'm a smart man. You are, and you would provide excellent counsel, I'm sure. So, Colonel, enjoy your trip to Michigan. We'll look forward to you seeing you next time. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on History Dweebs.
Good day.
Good day.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.